All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to today's meeting of the House Finance Committee. We are meeting for the purpose of public hearing all Senate bills today. We are going to start with the Gross Senate Substitute Bill 5531, starting with a staff briefing that I have no doubt is going to be very exciting, and I now see our prime sponsor. So this is going to be a fascinating bill briefing. Tracy Taylor, I'm turning it over to you. Everybody dial in and get ready to focus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Taylor, staff of the committee. Established in 1892, the Uniform Law Commission is a state-supported, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. It is comprised of state commissions on uniform laws from each state, the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, that is in Chapter 63.29 RCW, was adopted in 1983, but has been updated several times. In Gross Senate Bill 5531 adopts the Uniform Law Commission's 2016 update of the Uniform Unclaimed Property Act. In general, the act is updated to reflect the new types of intangible property, the sophistication of investment vehicles, and the changes in technology. The act now excludes the abandonment and custodial taking of unused tickets without an owner obligation to pay a refund, game-related digital content, loyalty cards, and ABLE accounts. The types of property specifically identified as now being subject to abandonment and custodial taking includes virtual currency, payroll cards, stored value cards, municipal bonds, health savings accounts, commissions, employee reimbursements, and custodial accounts for minors. The types of events that can trigger a presumption of abandonment are updated, and some even allow for contact of the apparent owner via email and as opposed to via the U.S. Postal Service. The dormancy period required for the presumption of abandonment is reduced from 5 years to 3 years for securities, debt obligations, deposit accounts, and miscellaneous types of intangible property. Specific time periods are provided for other types of property. The Act specifies actions that can be taken by the apparent owner that would indicate interest in the property and preclude the assumption of presumption of abandonment. The rules governing the prioritization of claims to custody of abandoned property among multiple states is revised and includes more specificity as to determining the appropriate address to determine the correct state. Holders' duties and responsibilities are revised, including the notification and reporting requirements. The confidentiality requirements are updated and include requirements for the security of information and the duties of notifications following a security breach. There are changes made to the Department of Revenue's administrative provisions, including notice requirements, the types of sales of abandoned property authorized, and examination procedures. The effective date is January 1st, 2023. There is a fiscal note available, and the department assumes that the bill would affect approximately 75,000 holders of property. There will be an increase in state general fund revenues in the amount of $35.4 million in fiscal year 23. This is primarily due to a timing change of insurance company reporting. As a result of the changes in the bill, insurance companies will report twice in fiscal year 23. This is the primary reason for the revenue increase in 23, and there will be no ongoing revenue impact from this change. The state general fund will also experience a revenue increase of $4.4 million in fiscal year 24. The fiscal year 24 impact is due primarily to the change in the presumption of abandonment for property held by a court from 2 years to 1 year. This is a one-time revenue impact. There will also be a one-year delay for the auctioning of safety deposit box contents due to the new two-year holding requirement. As a result, there will be alternating negative and positive impacts in fiscal years. For example, the additional delay will decrease revenues by $78,000 in fiscal year 25, but increase revenues by the same amount in fiscal year 26. The Department of Revenue expects to have expenditures of approximately $511,000 in this biennium and $809,000 in 23-25. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Less than 10 minutes. I am impressed. All right. Any questions for staff before we hear from our prime sponsor? Representative Springer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tracy, this may be a simplistic question, but who or what entity determines that abandonment has occurred. And after it has been determined that abandonment has occurred, what happens? What does that trigger?
Well, this law sets out who people who hold property for another person, such as a bank. If there is not activity, for example, on the account, this law tells the bank that at a certain point, if they've notified the holder of that account and they're not getting any response, there's no activity, that under the state law, they need to turn that over to the department for their unclaimed property. And there's a whole process to do that. The department also has examination authority to ensure that holders do not hold on to property longer than they should, that it should be turned over to the unclaimed property department for safekeeping and holding and for ease of finding for someone who's abandoned something for quite a long time.
Thank you. Any further questions for Tracy? Tracy, I'll just add a follow-up question based on what you just said. And you talked about the department holding unclaimed property and people being able to find it. And that is that searchable online database now where people can put in their name and like birthday maybe to search if there's any unclaimed property assigned to them. Is that what you're referring to?
Correct. There also are some requirements within the Act regarding publishing information in newspapers. And there, I believe there's a larger database or connection across states as well.
Great. Okay, thank you. Any further questions for staff? All right, Senator Peterson, welcome back to the Finance Committee. Please tell us, I would say about your good little bill, but that would be a lie. Tell us about your tremendously long, hefty bill doing good work. Senator Peterson, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Jamie Peterson from the 43rd Legislative District. So, I guess I want to start by putting this bill a little bit in context, and Representative Springer, hopefully this helps for you as well. You know, there are businesses have all sorts of property that they're holding on to owned by consumers. And the point of this law is to try to get the property back to the rightful owner of the property, right? So this whole structure that has evolved over a long period of time really says, hey, we want to make sure that businesses don't just pocket money that belongs to someone else. And so we're going to create a structure in each state to help make sure that the real owner is identified and that we can help get the property back. The Uniform Law Commission first promulgated a Uniform Unclaimed Property Act in the 1950s, and Washington has had some version of the act since then. The update that is before us is the fourth update to that act. The Uniform Law Commission finished it in 2016. We missed the third update to the act in the early 2000s. And as a result, we're working with a version of the Unclaimed Property Act that was promulgated in the early 1980s. So if you think about how property has evolved in the last 40 years since that version came out, there are a lot of kinds of intangible property that just didn't exist 40 years ago, and as a result are not covered by our current unclaimed property statute. And those include everything from sort of loyalty cards and health savings accounts. So the big point of this bill is to update the law so that it more comprehensively and specifically and clearly covers all the different kinds of property and helps them get back to their rightful owners. When the state takes charge of the property, it holds it for a period of time and tries to get it back to the owner. After a period when it becomes really abandoned, then it moves into the general fund. Although I want to note promptly that that the real owner can always come back later and get the money or get the property back from the state. But because of that function, this is a significant revenue source for the state over time as unclaimed property moves into the general fund. That has made this bill very tricky because there are all sorts of good ideas that people have for changing the current statute that would then create significant fiscal notes for the bill. And so Representative Graves first prime sponsored a version of this, and then Representative Tarleton. And in each case, there were sort of well-meaning amendments that then got the bill to die in House Appropriations when we got the fiscal note back from the Department of Revenue. So my general principle, and I really want to thank Representative Frame for the cooperation on this, and also give credit to my second sponsor, Senator Wilson, who has been a very strong partner in working on this, is that we're trying to adopt as much of the new Uniform Act as possible, except when that's creating some significant policy change that's a fiscal change for the state of Washington. In those cases, we in the bill, we have gone back to existing Washington law. And so I think everything that you'll see in 5531 is one or the other of those choices. And I hope that we maintain that policy as it moves through the House. I'm certainly open to other ideas, but I just want to make sure that it doesn't cause a problem in terms of revenue. And as I've discussed over and over again with Senator Wilson and then with various folks who have raised ideas for how to change our unclaimed property statute, I'm more than happy to come back in future years and consider those kinds of changes. So anyway, really appreciate your looking at this. Senator Rolfes was rueful because she thought that when I stopped being the Law and Justice Chair that she would stop having to see big complicated bills like this. And alas, she was incorrect. I will say on a happier note, while we were in Ways and Means, Senator Mullett found some of his unclaimed property on the site. So I encourage all of you to go look and see if you can find some of your own unclaimed property.
Thank you, Senator. I think I have about $25 waiting for me to be claimed. So I encourage everybody to go look at that website. Thank you. I see a number of questions. Let's start with Mr. Ranking Member Orcutt. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I did hear you mention that any changes to this would have a fiscal note, but I guess what I'm wondering is why is it the proceeds are automatically deposited into the state general fund, even though there's $250,000 kept in a separate fund? Why would they go directly into the general fund rather than into another fund to hold for a while, and then after a certain time period, be released into the general fund?
You know, you'll have to ask Department of Revenue, because I think they're signed up, about exactly how they do that. Representative Orcutt, thank you for the question. Nice to see you. My understanding is that they essentially escrow things that come in for a while. Ultimately, I think the view is that there's plenty of money hanging around in the general, and there's plenty of money coming into this account constantly that they're able to deal with people who, it's not as if we run short when we have folks coming forward and wanting to claim their property, and they're able to process those promptly. But I don't know how this bill doesn't change those policies. That's just the underlying. That's what the Department of Revenue has worked out over many years in terms of how with the Treasury, I guess, for how they handle it.
Great, thanks, Senator Peterson. And I do see the department has signed up to testify, so we could ask that question again in a bit if we want to. Representative Young, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, Senator Peterson, I saw coming out of the committee in the report that there was some business-to-business credit balance concerns. Did you guys end up working that out as you made it to the floor, or have you had a chance to think about that? And what are your thoughts there, if there's starting to see some movement?
Yeah, so the issue there is that we decided not to make a change to existing state law. There is a certain amount, I mean, I think that they're already exempt. There's some desire, I think, to make that more explicit. But we are not changing in this bill, we're not changing existing state law about those credit balances. And I think the concern is that the language that some folks had proposed about the B2B credit balances would have resulted in a fiscal note that we didn't want to take on in the Senate.
Great. Any further questions for our prime sponsor? Well, Senator, I have to say, this is one of the few bills you get to read in the legislature where literally start to finish, the entire bill is new section, new section, new section, new section. It's kind of a treat. So thank you for that lovely little insight into the legislative process.
Thank you very much for hearing the bill.
You got appreciate it. All right. With that, let's move to public hearing. Thank you, Senator Peterson. You're welcome to stay, but also welcome to go. I will turn it over to Vice Chair Berg. Vice Chair Berg, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we will begin testimony with Steve Ewing and then Tommy Gantt and Bill Stoffischer. And let's see if we see Mr. Ewing. There we go. Go ahead, Mr. Ewing.
Thank you. And good afternoon, Chair Frame, Vice Chair Berg, Ranking Member Orcutt, members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Steve Ewing. I'm the Legislative and External Affairs Liaison for the Department of Revenue. Thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 5531. The department is neutral. DOR administers the state's unclaimed property program, and so this legislation is of great interest to the department. We take great pride in our work and are pleased to help Washingtonians obtain property that is rightfully theirs. In the last three fiscal years, we returned over $221 million to claimants. Last year, we implemented a new fast-track process for expedited approval of some unclaimed property claims, sparing owners the hassle of having to upload proof documents. To that end, DOR has an amendment request of the committee, which Senator Peterson, the bill sponsor, has graciously okayed. Senate Bill 5531 is based off of template language. That template contains a $250 limit to the value of property that can be fast-tracked. However, DOR currently allows claims up to $1,000 to be fast-tracked. We would ask that the language specifying a dollar amount be removed from the bill. There is no dollar amount specified in law currently, and amending the bill would require changing just two or three lines. Our unclaimed property division professionals are highly qualified to know what is a good dollar amount to strike a balance of convenience with security, and removing the language in the bill will ensure they can exercise sound judgment. Our amendment would eliminate about $70,000 of administrative expense every fiscal year and would ensure the expedient return of property rightfully belonging to Washingtonians. We hope a member of the committee might take up this amendment ahead of executive session on Friday. Chair Frame, Vice Chair Berg, Ranking Member Orcutt, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions. And Chair Frame, I also do have a response that I can provide to, I believe it was Ranking Member Orcutt's question.
Perfect. Nice to see Mr. Ranking Member's got his hand up, so go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is in regards to your testimony. If you do have an answer to my question and are sending it to me, that's fine. But my question here is, with a minimum number of dollar value in there, we say that anything below $250 must be expedited. You say we don't need that in there, but I'd look at it and say, should we not have something like that in there so that if another administration comes in and decides they want to have something that's a lower threshold, wouldn't this help prevent them from doing that?
Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, the threshold amount or the maximum amount that is allowed of the property value to be fast-tracked is not something that we must fast-track under that amount. For instance, if in the fast-tracking process, if the data that a claimant provides on our website does not quite meet what we have in terms of data attributed to the property, then the claimant would receive a form and go through the normal application process just like any property over $1,000. So we don't want any property going out to anyone who shouldn't be receiving it. And so there is no obligation or commitment in that fast tracking process. It is entirely up to the discretion and good judgment of the folks who work in this day in and day night, or day in and all night on this program.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Ranking Member, did I hear you were fine with the response on the escrow general fund, how that thing worked by email? Or would you prefer he respond now?
No, it's fine. He can do that by email, especially if it's a little more complicated. Yeah. But please do share the answer to that with all members of the committee.
Yeah, I agree. Sure. Thank you so much. All right, Rep. Harris-Talley, go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Chair Frame, and thank you so much for this testimony. You noted in your testimony that if the amendment that you proposed were to happen, there would be a $70,000 saving. Is that due to staffing considerations? Where would those savings come from with considerations of the fiscal note? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Frame, Representative Harris-Talley. That's right. The $70,000 in administrative expense savings is because we estimate that that is the cost of now having to fully review claims between $250, which is what 5531 currently says, and the current practice of $1,000. So it'll cost us about $70,000 a year more to review those claims in between $250 and $1,000.
All right, I see Rep. Young's got his question, and then we'll go back to public testimony. Rep. Young, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Frame. Yeah, I'm just curious, did you try the amendment in the Senate, or did you just kind of come to this conclusion as it was making its way through? Want to get your opinion as to why not there and why here.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Frame, Representative Young. This was something that we frankly, the pace with which this bill moved in the Senate, we were focused on another matter in the Senate, and this was just something that we we're hoping to try now that we have a little bit more time in the House. Again, it's something that Senator Peterson has kindly okayed, and but we recognize that we are doing this in the second chamber, but it is a very minor change.
Mr. Ranking Member, quickly.
Yes, just very quickly. Mr. Young, can you tell us where that 250 is in the bill? What page, your line number, section somewhere?
Yes, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, that is section 903 of the bill. I think it's page 35, I believe.
Great. All right, I'm gonna ask that we now have another prime sponsor with us. So if we could really quickly do the last couple bits of testimony here and then wrap up this hearing, and then we can go to Senator Kaiser's bill. So back to you, Vice Chair Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Go ahead, Tommy.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berg. Thank you, Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tommy Gantz with the Association of Washington Business, serving over 7,000 Washington State businesses. One of the AWB tax principles is that the revenue system should be administered equitably, efficiently, uniformly, and professionally. And to that end, there are a lot of good things in this bill. We would have liked to have seen the inclusion of the B2B exemption or the business-to-business exemption, but we understand that this would have created, we think, roughly a $6 million fiscal note, which is why it's not included. And that is why we are signed in as other today. Thank you for the opportunity to speak regarding Senate Bill 5531.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Stoffaker, before you today on behalf of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, your broker dealers, both here in the state and throughout the country, testifying to other on this bill with a technical correction for your consideration. In section 202, that is the section to look at in this technical correction, and that's section when a tax deferred account is presumed abandoned. In recent years, federal law has changed specific to the minimum distribution a person must withdraw from a tax deferred retirement account each year. A person generally must start taking those withdrawals now at the age of 72. The age remains 70 and a half if a person is that age before January 1, 2020. That's a change, a recent change in federal law. It was longstanding before moving to the age of 72. It was 70 and a half years old. The bill in Section 202 identifies that age still as 70 and a half. That's a change that should be made to go reflect that change to 72. And then those individuals at 70 before January 1, 2020. I also believe that the Uniform Law Commission is already working to make this change in their activities. And I will, for the record, tell you, all of you should search DOR's website, because I am awaiting a check. And with a kid in college, I am happy to take anything. And it is more than your $25, Madam Chair. So I'm a winner, winner.
Chicken dinner. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
Mr. Sofker.
Everyone should search. Please do so.
Thank you, Mr. Sofker. Vice Chair Berg, do we have anybody else wanting to testify today?
We do not, Madam Chair. We have two people signed in not testifying, and they are both in the pro position.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berg. So for committee members' benefit, I had heard about the amendment related to the age of moving from 70 and a half to 72. I've got that amendment ready to go, and I'm happy to corral other technical amendments that have been vetted through this process. So folks are welcome to reach out to me directly. All right, with that, let us close the hearing for Engross Substitute Senate Bill 5531. Let's jump down to Engross Senate Substitute Senate Bill 5004, starting with a staff briefing from Rochelle Harris, and then we'll hear from our prime sponsor. Ms. Harris, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Frame. In a wild pivot in subject matter, Engross Substitute Senate Bill 5004 relates to the taxation of medical marijuana products. Retail sales of all marijuana concentrates, usable marijuana, and marijuana-infused products in the state are subject to an excise tax of 37%. This tax is in addition to the state and local sales and use taxes. Revenues from the excise portion of the tax are deposited into the dedicated marijuana account. Certain Washington state residents qualify for medical marijuana use. All medical marijuana patients must pay the marijuana excise tax on purchases of marijuana products of 37%. Qualifying patients that hold a recognition card are granted a sales and use tax exemption on medical marijuana qualifying products when sold by a marijuana retailer that has a medical marijuana endorsement. Engross Substitute Senate Bill 5004 exempts sales of medical marijuana products to qualifying patients from the 37% excise tax until June 30th, 2027. Each seller making exempt sales must maintain information establishing eligibility for the exemption in a form and manner required by the Liquor and Cannabis Board, and the LCB must provide a separate tax reporting line on the excise tax form for exemption amounts claimed. The JLARC is required to review the exemption to identify changes in consumer behavior and to determine whether the exemption results in unanticipated decreases in state revenue. The JLARC must report their findings to the legislature by December 1st, 2025. A fiscal note's available, and the bill is estimated to reduce revenues to the dedicated marijuana account by about $9,600 over the four-year period. And JLARC also estimates general fund costs related to the review of the preference of about $233,000 over that same four-year period. That concludes my remarks.
Hey, Ms. Harris, any questions for staff before we hear from our finance sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Kaiser, welcome to the Finance Committee. Why don't you tell us about your bill?
Well, thank you so very much, Chair Frame and members of the Finance Committee. I don't think I've ever been before the House Finance Committee before. It's great to be here. My name is Senator Karen Kaiser from the 33rd Legislative District, and I have a proud seatmate sitting on this committee, Representative Orwell. So I have a little modest tax cut bill here for you that I think will do some good for patients of cannabis who use cannabis to deal with some of their conditions, and I think for our state as well. Currently, cannabis patients who go to a retail store have to pay the 37% excise tax that's on all products in that store. I am asking that we take the excise tax off these products, and they are special products, mostly things that are smoking. They're salves and oils and various products that can help all kinds of conditions, whether it's glaucoma or arthritis. In fact, seniors are the largest growing customers of these products in our retail stores. With a 37% excise tax, though, we have seen that many people have turned to what I'd call a gray market for these products. And that means they're not Department of Health certified products. That is, they're not tested for pesticides or other contaminants. And the patients are not on the Department of Health registry. So by kind of escaping regulation and going into the gray market, we're undercutting what we really do need is to have a regulated market, in my opinion, for cannabis. Many retail cannabis stores no longer even carry the products because they have so few customers anymore, even though there's a lot of use. This bill has a study and a sunset clause, so we will track whether, in fact, there's an increase in sales of these products at our retail stores. And if indeed there's some kind of impact on our budget, that would be tracked as well. The fiscal note shows just the minor, just less than $10,000 impact at this point in terms of revenues, because people are not buying these products that are very helpful. I will just say, the other day, this was on Super Bowl Sunday, I had a neck spasm, and a friend of mine gave me a salve called Flow, and I looked at it, it had CBD, and I used it, and I don't have a neck spasm anymore. I tell you, it's a true story.
All right, thank you, Senator Kaiser. I see we have a couple questions. Rep. Harris-Talley, go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Chair Frame, and thank you for bringing this bill forward, Senator Kaiser. So I know as a state that started with medical only prescription, that one of the big concerns in moving to a recreational market were considerations of the increased cost of medications. Could you give me a sense of what you're hearing directly from neighbors about sort of what that cost margin has looked like? I think particularly in the context, just generally how much medications cost right now, it's an important part of this consideration.
Absolutely. We don't put an excise tax on any other over-the-counter or prescription drug. We don't do that to patients, and we shouldn't do it to patients who have conditions that are treated and can be treated with cannabis. So I just find it totally inequitable for people who need to deal with their arthritis or with any other medical issue that can be helped with cannabis. I was in the healthcare committee when we were first looking at the legalization of what was called medical marijuana. And it was heartfelt testimony from hundreds of people who were using the gray market of illegal, at that time, marijuana to alleviate all kinds of ailments, including real pain. And I believe that it does have great benefit for some people.
Thank you. Mr. Ranking Member, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, as somebody who sits on JLARC and specifically the JLARC Executive Committee, I realize sometimes we wrestle with, you know, what is being asked of us to do. And so I just want to ask, how well is consumer behavior defined in what you're asking JLARC to study? Have you checked in with JLARC staff to make sure that this is written such that they actually have something they can quantify and actually do an auditor quality study on?
Rep. Orcott, I was not the author of the JLARC study. That was inserted by the chair of our Ways and Means Committee, who had concerns that over time we should track the changes in behavior and in consumer behavior, that is, in terms of purchases. And that was something she thought was valuable. I don't know that it is necessary.
Thank you, Senator Kaiser. And Mr. Ranking Member, I'm looking to you that perhaps we can ask Keenan to take a look at the definition to see if that's helpful or not. Because I appreciate your question.
Yeah, it's not my intent to have that taken out. I just want to make sure it's worded such that They can quantify it and do a professional grade audit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have any problem with a change in language for that measurement.
I think it'd be great to talk to Jayla. They are super, always excited when we call to ask them for their advice on this work. So great. Okay. Rep Morgan and then Rep Springer. Go ahead, Rep Morgan.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Kaiser, for bringing this bill forward. If you could clarify for me, the salve that you talked about using is actually over-the-counter in a recreational store of CBD, but in fact, the excise tax that you're speaking of is actually comes with a medical prescription from a doctor.
Right.
So just to distinguish between medical, if you could clarify that.
It's not actually a medical prescription, Rep. Morgan, but you do have to be a registered patient with the Department of Health registry. You do not need anymore to have anybody write you a script. You can go to a retail store and purchase any Department of Health certified product for that.
Good clarification. Rep. Springer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Kaiser. I think you might have just answered my question. So if I have that registration as a medical cannabis user, can I go to a recreational store and buy any product in there and avoid the 37%?
This would only be for products that have the label, the Department of Health certification label. And that would apply only to those products.
So have we, if I can follow up, Madam Chair. So that brings then the question, maybe this is an issue we may need to deal with at a later time, but there's been some pretty compelling testimony back when we were first considering medical marijuana at that time, and certainly here recently on a couple of TV specials about the impact of CBD in forms that we don't consider medical for the treatment of epilepsy, autism. So that would not be covered by this bill.
It is, there's so many different changes happening currently in the industry. If it is sold as a medical cannabis product and is certified by Department of Health as being safe and pure, in other words, isn't contaminated with metals or pesticides and so forth, then it would be under this exemption for the excise tax, but otherwise not. But if they are certified and have the label, they could be.
Okay, thank you.
So I think to clarify, Rep. Sir, the products that are not certified today, if they became certified at a later date,
that's right,
they would be covered under this if they meet that. They're designated as such under the rules later.
That's right. And I would also just mention that most of these products really don't have the THC levels that create impairing impacts on people. So it doesn't have the normal mental impacts that you get with, say, smoking cannabis that you have for recreational purposes. And as they say nowadays, the cannabis you buy is not the cannabis you had 20 years ago.
Senator Kaiser, thank you so much. Let us move from this very robust discussion on two very different topics today so far. It's a fun finance committee today.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the time and your questions, and I hope you'll support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaiser. You're welcome to stay, but also welcome to go as we move to public
your meeting.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, Madam Vice Chair, I'll turn it over to you for our testifiers today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first we'll hear from Laura Kaminsky, Danielle Rollinson, and Hannah Keefe Guerrero. And on deck we'll have Chris Thompson and Stephen Field. Go ahead, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Frame and members of the committee. My name is Laura Kaminsky, and I'm the Government Affairs Liaison for the Cannabis Alliance, serving more than 200 members comprised of cannabis farmers and retailers, as well as consumers and patients. We are here testifying in strong support of 5004. As you heard in the staff briefing under state law, all retail cannabis sales are subject to an almost 40% excise tax, regardless of if the purchaser is a patient or not. This is in addition to state and local sales tax. We are seeing a continued and growing percentage of patients who are staying out of the regulated market entirely, as you heard, because it does not serve their needs. This lack of engagement and trust in our regulated system is underscored by the very small fiscal note that appears specifically related to the tax exemption. The top three reasons we hear that patients are staying out of the regulated market are the cost, the fear of inadequate testing, and the lack of medical-grade products in the store. Department of Health compliant products are the only highly tested products that meet the concern that patients have regarding quality assurance, but there's a serious lack of these products in the market. And the cost of the few products that are compliant with DOH standards with the 37% excise tax is far out of the range of chronically ill patients who are disproportionately poor and whose need is generally greater. This legislation removes only that tax on these highly tested DOH compliant products and only for patients who are registered in the database. This change on a small segment of the market goes a long way to address the top three reasons patients are not accessing the regulated market. Additionally, I want to take a moment to underscore that while we continue to evolve this new industry, we need to take better care of our patients who are the people most in need of safe, regulated medicinal cannabis. This legislation has been presented in front of the legislature no less than three times, and every time gets so very close to the end. It is time to get it over the finish line. Our patients cannot afford to wait another year for this relief. In closing, I would like to remind the committee that you passed the same piece of legislation out last year with a strong 16-1 vote. So we sincerely hope for your support again this year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Danielle.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for having me today. My name is Danielle Rosellison, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Trailblazin Productions. 100% of the product that Trailblazin produces has been DOH certified as medical marijuana for the last 5 years. Out of 1,500 producer processors in Washington state, Trailblazin isn't one of only four that certify any product as medical marijuana. That's less than 0.3% of licensed growers. I'm here today to ask for your support of SB 5004. Why, you might be thinking, do only 0.3% of producer processors certify their product as medical? Oh, let me count the ways. First of all, patients and veterans are often on fixed incomes, but they need the best quality products for their health. Eliminating the 37% excise tax for patients, which is the highest on medical marijuana in the country, makes sure that our patients have access to affordable healthcare. Number two, currently registered patients only get sales tax off the purchase of their cannabis. However, the burden is such that every single retailer I know gives anybody who says they're a patient 10% off. This leads many patients and veterans to purchase whatever is suggested, which may or may not be in the best interest of the patient. What's to keep a retailer from suggesting product that they get the highest ROI on, but that isn't pesticide or heavy metal tested? That isn't in the best interest of the patient or veteran. Passing this bill will make sure that patients and veterans have affordable access to their medicine. Did you know that there's no requirement for medical marijuana endorsed stores to actually carry medical marijuana? Passing 5004 will ensure that medical marijuana endorsed stores at a very minimum know about medical marijuana and carry it for their patients and needy veterans. Medical marijuana is expensive to grow, and it's expensive to test. The test can run up to $200,000 a year. I'm sorry, I'm watching the time. Since there's been no real education behind the DOH program on a state level and the loco is not self-explanatory, we're not seeing demand for DOH products that there should be. So in closing, I'll be done. Thanks. Thank you for your support.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Hannah.
Thank you. I would like to begin with a thank you to the chair and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Keefe-Gadrero, and I have returned unchanged this year to testify for Bill 5004. In July 2019, I was diagnosed with an anaplastic astrocytoma 3, an aggressive and recurrent form of third-grade brain cancer. I will continue to have surveillance MRIs every 3 to 4 months for the rest of my life. I'm now 30 years old. After complete resection, I discovered my brain functioned differently than before surgery. I struggled with complications from seizures, memory issues, language, and my nervous system. The change in my nervous system has been especially difficult because I react much more strongly to stressors, cannot control my moods, nor my anxiety. I've also, more recently, developed several lasting physical side effects resulting from chemo. After surgery, I became dependent on Social Security disability and have been unable to work due to treatment and its resulting long-term effects during COVID. I rely on several programs such as free healthcare and food assistance services. I also have some financial help from a parent, but nonetheless, I barely have enough for monthly rent and utilities, let alone the cost of medical cannabis. After surgery, another AA3 brain cancer patient connected me to support programs like SMJ Consulting and Ames Institute. Through these programs, I learned medical cannabis is clinically proven to specifically help brain cancer patients by inhibiting the growth of cancerous brain cells. I also discovered that microdosing medical cannabis significantly helps manage my mental and physical symptoms. It helps me go through each day without digestive issues resulting from chemo, crippling anxiety, heavy mood swings, and mental breakdowns that may otherwise make it difficult to do something so simple as leave my apartment. Even with the incredible amount of support I'm so lucky to receive, the cost of medical cannabis is a financial strain, and I rely heavily on credit cards to help cover the cost. The main reason I've been able to access this literally life-saving medicine is because of the support programs with organizations like SMJ Consulting. I cannot emphasize the importance of this medicine in my daily life and how important it is for improving and extending the quality and longevity of my life. This bill will make a huge impact on my life by reducing the cost of highly tested medical cannabis, something I rely on to survive. I have returned again this year to urge you to please pass this important piece of legislation. Thank you for your time and attention, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Hannah. Go ahead, Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Thompson here with the Liquor and Cannabis Board. Happy to and proud to be in support of Engross Substitute Senate Bill 5004. A few years ago, our board identified three top policy priority areas, and this legislation is directly related to one of them. Our board sees a very significant need to strengthen the medical market. Colloquially, we talk about medical cannabis, but the term of art is Department of Health compliant product, and we think this legislation is probably the most powerful tool before you this session to help make some major progress in this area. We've heard a lot about problems for years in the medical market. There's insufficient production. There's a lack of reliable inventory found on the shelves in retail stores. It seems also there's inadequate knowledge about these products among bud tenders who are interacting with customers in the store and patients. Among a number of other concerns. We think this legislation could do a number of things that you've already heard alluded to in other testimony. It could incentivize more production. It could incentivize testing labs to expand their capability to do the testing necessary for this type of product line. And we're pretty limited there right now, particularly heavy metal testing capacity among our labs. And in terms of the fiscal impact, our fiscal note, you know, kind of assumes a steady state of product volume. There's a lot we don't know. It could incentivize patients to get on the registry to gain access to this tax incentive. It could bring them out of the gray market into the legal market. There could be enough of an increase that we have more revenue loss than otherwise we might have, but that also could be offset. So we don't know in the end. We can't project those things, but we think the fiscal impact is modest. And I'm out of time, I see. I'll stop there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Chris. Madam Chair, that does conclude our testimony. We have a couple of folks wishing not to testify, 29 in the pro position and 12 in the con position.
All right. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. With that, we will conclude the hearing. But before we do, just a point of personal privilege. Hannah, thank you so much for continuing to share your story and coming back year after year. It does make a difference. So just thank you for your graciousness and your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's go ahead and close the hearing on engross substitute Senate Bill 5004. Let's go back up to the list. Let's go to engross Senate Bill 5800, starting with a staff briefing from Kyle Raymond. This is another very exciting bill. You all have made very complicated bills very exciting today, so tune in. We got another one. Mr. Raymond, over to you.
Thank you, Chair Frame, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Raymond, committee staff. Engross Senate Bill 5800 is an act relating to modifying tax and revenue laws in a manner that is estimated to not affect state or local tax collections by easing compliance burdens for taxpayers, clarifying ambiguities, making technical corrections, and providing administrative efficiencies. The bill does make a number of these changes, so I'll highlight some of the main changes, but an exhaustive list is included in the bill analysis. So first, the bill requires that unclaimed excess funds from a public auction of an abandoned aircraft be deposited by the Department of Revenue into an aeronautics account rather than depositing the funds into an account that no longer exists. In addition, the bill allows the Department of Revenue to disclose licensing information to a peace officer or county prosecuting attorney related to a business license or license application review, investigation, or enforcement activity. And this is as compared to under current statute, a search warrant, subpoena, or court order is required to disclose such information unless it is for the purpose of investigating a criminal or license enforcement issue. Next, the bill also removes the requirement that the Department of Revenue report annually to the legislature regarding compliance with the streamlined sales and use tax agreement, and instead requires the Department of Revenue to report to the legislature if legislation is required to keep Washington in compliance with the agreement. And this report would be due January 1st of the year immediately following any such legislation being enacted. Also, the bill allows the Department of Revenue to disclose return or tax information of an individual that is part of a marital community for amounts due under a warrant issued by the Department of Revenue. And this is if the return or tax information is directly related to that individual's liability. In addition, the bill expires rural county business and occupation tax credits for new employees for related to businesses that have closed. So with this change, the credit may expire 6 years from the later of the year that the Department of Revenue is notified that a business has ceased operations, either by the recipient or the representative, 6 years from DOR closing the recipient's tax reporting account, or 6 years from the recipient when the recipient last claimed a credit on a return filed with the Department of Revenue. And the final change I'll mention is that the bill provides for pro-rationing for the state property tax levies for the support of common schools. So this allows the Department of Revenue to lower both the state school levy rates on a proportional basis in the event that the combined rate limit of $3.60 per 1,000 of assessed value is exceeded. And I'll just note the method for pro-rationing was not included when the legislation was enacted in 2017. A fiscal note is available on the bill. The bill does not impact state or local revenues. The Department of Revenue estimates a one-time cost of about $29,000 in fiscal year 2023. And this is for labor costs related to updating publications and notices on DOR's website, responding to inquiries, and amending 5 administrative rules. And with that, Madam Chair, happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Raymond. Any questions for staff? Great. We will not hear from our prime sponsor today. He had a conflict, but I will just send my good wishes and thanks to Senator Schessler, who has brought bills like this before us multiple times before, and I'm grateful to him for the good work of bringing it forward. Representative Berg, I will turn it over to you for public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my computer froze a little bit, so we just to confirm, we're on 5800?
Yes, correct.
That's where it came back on at, so I'm going to go with it. Okay, first we're going to hear from Steve Ewing, and next will be Jack Brombaugh. Go ahead, Steve.
All right, well, thank you. Chair Frame, members of the House Finance Committee, once again, my name is Steve Ewing. I'm Legislative and External Affairs Liaison for the Department of Revenue. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 5800, The department is also grateful to Senator Schessler, who so graciously worked with us to identify opportunities in DOR's parts of the revised code to make minor technical cleanups, the end result being clearer language for taxpayers to comply with. DOR works hard to be an efficient and trusted administrator of tax laws, and this bill supports that. On their own, each of the changes in the bill is relatively minor. For example, deleting a reference to an account that no longer exists, clarifying the intent of past legislation, or changing an outmoded bill definition. There are no policy changes in the bill, and there is no fiscal impact to the bill other than a small expenditure for DOR implementation. I think we'd all agree tax laws are complicated enough as it is. DOR is grateful to Senator Schessler for this bill, and thank you, Chair Frame, and committee members for considering it and allowing me to express DOR support. I have Jack Brumbaugh with me to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Jack, did you wish to testify, or are you here for questions only?
Chair Frame, Ranking Member Orcutt, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Brumbaugh, Legislative Policy Coordinator with the Department of Revenue, here in support of engrossed Senate Bill 5800. I do not have prepared testimony on this bill. However, I am available to help provide answers to any questions that members of the committee may have about the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Mr. Ewing or Mr. Brumbaugh? We've run out of steam, everybody. Okay, well, with that, Madam Vice Chair, do we have anybody else wishing to testify or anybody not wishing to testify that we need to read into record?
Madam Chair, we have nobody wishing to testify. We have one person not wishing to testify in the pro position.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Ewing and Mr. Brumbaugh. You are off the hook. We are closing the hearing for engrossed Senate Bill 5800, and we'll move to our last hearing for the day, Senate Bill 5505, starting with the staff briefing from Tracy Taylor. Ms. Taylor, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tracy Taylor, staff to the committee. All real and personal property is subject to a tax each year based on the highest and best use, unless a specific exemption is provided by law. Some nonprofits are eligible for property tax exemption, which is dependent on specifically identified qualifying activities that are being conducted on the property. Examples of organizations that may receive a property tax exemption for their property are schools, churches, cemeteries, hospitals, social service agencies, museums, performing arts, and public meeting halls. Nonprofit organizations seeking an exemption for their property based on qualifying activities may not use the exempt property for business purposes more than 15 days each year. The nonprofit is also restricted to loaning or renting the property to individuals or organizations for non-exempt purposes for no more than 50 days per year. For public meeting halls that are owned by a nonprofit to qualify for an exemption, the property must be used for public gatherings and be available to all organizations or individuals that desire the use of the property. Membership may not be a prerequisite for the use of this property. The use of the property for business activities may disqualify the property from the exemption. Churches are eligible for property tax exemption if they conduct activities that are wholly used for church purposes and the land does not exceed 5 acres. For property taxes levied for collection from 2011 through 2020, a provision existed to allow churches and public assemblies halls to host farmers markets for an additional 53 days per year without losing the property tax exemption. That provision expired on December 31st, 2020. Under Senate Bill 5505, public meeting halls and churches owned by a nonprofit may use their exempted property to conduct qualifying farmers markets for more than 53 days per year. All income received from rental or use of the exempt property is to be used for capital improvements to the exempt property, maintenance and operation of the exempt property, or for exempt purposes. The exemption applies retroactively and prospectively to taxes levied for collection in 2021 and thereafter. This bill is exempt from a tax performance statement, a jailer review, and does not expire. There is a fiscal note available, and this bill would not result in any revenue impact at the state or local level. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Taylor? I see Ms. Ranking Member. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tracy, this seems like deja vu all over again. We had a House bill on this, I believe. Can you remind us what that House bill was and explain what differences there might be between this bill and the bill we passed or we heard earlier?
Sure. Both bills use the same definition of qualifying farmers market and the number of days being 53 days or less. They both apply to the same types of property. However, the House version required that the rental income and donations be reasonable and not exceed the maintenance and operating expenses attributed to the portion of the property loaned or rented to the farmers market. The Senate bill is a little bit broader on the use of funds. Income received from the rental or use can be used to make capital improvements to the exempt property, maintenance and operation of the exempt property, and exempt purposes. It also varies on how when it starts applying to taxes. The House bill applied to taxes levied for collection in 2023 and thereafter. The Senate bill was retroactive and prospective for taxes levied for collection in 2021 and thereafter.
Thank you for that explanation. Any further questions? Otherwise, we will go to public testimony. All right, Madam Vice Chair, over to you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. We'll hear from Colleen Donovan, Lars Sorensen, and Elizabeth Paruchiru. Thank you. Go ahead, Colleen.
Hello, Chair Frame and members of the committee. My name is Colleen Donovan, and I am the Executive Director of the Washington State Farmers Market Association, and I am here in support of this bill. The WSFMA represents 115 farmers markets throughout the state. One of our largest programs is actually a food access program that supports SNAP and the Farmers Market Nutrition Program for seniors and WIC. Several of our market member markets and allies have been working together on this bill since we found out about the issue in early July. And it may seem very, very minor, but it's very, very important to us. As explained, the WSFMA has worked with legislatures in 2010 to get this issue addressed, but that legislation included a sunset clause, and so I think the technical term is sunset on December 31st, 2020. So what this bill does is, again, it helps us to get the days allowed up to 53, and we really, really appreciate that going back to 2021. So that allows our farmers markets to plan for 2022 with certainty without any risk of losing their property this year. So that's incredibly important to us. We are aware of the Senate Bill 1967. So we appreciate that reference, and that clarification was really helpful. Again, thank you so much for your interest in supporting farmers markets and addressing this issue today.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Lars.
Hello, thank you for having me. Hello, Chair Frame and members of the committee. My name is Lars Sorensen of the San Juan Islands Agricultural Guild, and I'm here in support of the bill. We're a 501c3 nonprofit that owns Brickworks Event Center, Public Assembly Hall, and we are the landlord of the San Juan Islands Farmers Market in Friday Harbor. The bill is important to us because our community went through a tremendous effort to buy and renovate Brickworks with the specific purpose of providing a year-round farmers market in the heart of Friday Harbor. The market is open 34 times per year, supporting over 50 small businesses that generate over $450,000 in sales each year. With the 15-day restriction, we would lose our property tax exemption if we continue to rent to the farmers market. Keeping the market location in the heart of Friday Harbor is critical, and it would economically be devastating if the market was forced to move. Please support this bill. It is critical to the economic success of our farmers market and the health of our community to access locally produced food. And again, thank you so much for letting me speak.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hello, Chair Frame and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Paruchiru, and I'm the Market Engagement Manager for the Bellevue Farmers Market. I'm here in support of this bill. We're scheduled to begin our 19th season this May. That is, if we can keep our home in the parking lot of the Bellevue Presbyterian Church. Our small nonprofit represents and serves over 40 vendors. In 2021, we had over 25,000 customer visits, along with hundreds of children that participated in our free youth activities. We provide an important venue for regional farmers and small businesses to connect with our Bellevue and Seattle suburban east side neighbors. Our marketplace accepts SNAP, WIC, senior benefits, and we're the only local market to administer the Market Match program. These programs help those who cannot traditionally afford fresh, high quality produce. Many organizations face difficulty in obtaining space. We're so grateful for our partnership with Bell Press. We have sought additional market sites in the past, but we've been unsuccessful. In Bellevue, as in many places, the demand is very high and land is limited, often because it is still in the process of being developed. If this bill does not pass, the impact on our Bellevue community and regional farmers will be great. And it does not bode well for the future of farmers markets as space continues to be crunched. Please help us continue to use vacant spaces for the benefit of the public. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair, that concludes our testimony. We have 75 signed in as pro as well, not wishing to testify.
Great. Thank you so much, Madam Vice Chair. With that, we will close out the hearing for Senate Bill.
Madam Chair?
Sorry, I did not see your hand up. Rep. Rammel, go ahead.
No, I was slow on it. Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for staff, actually. I'm just curious, if we pass this unamended in the House and the Senate passes the House version unamended in the Senate, do we know which one controls? I just don't know what happens in that scenario.
I believe it is a timing issue on how it exactly happens, but it would end up with notes in the statute from the code revisor noting that they were both passed, and it would cause a little bit of confusion.
I think we saw that play out with the broadband bills last year, if I recall. Yes, Mr. Ranking Member, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One potential solution is if both bills made it to the governor's desk, he could veto one or the other. That's a situation that actually happened to me once, where inadvertently we passed a Senate bill and a House bill with the exact same language. They both made it to the governor's desk. And unfortunately, mine was the one that got vetoed.
Oh my goodness, fun. All right, team, let's go ahead and close out that hearing then for Senate Bill 5505. We have some time left in our committee hearing time. So Democrats, we're gonna caucus. Mr. Ranking Member, I just sent you a message. I'm hoping you all will spend some time caucusing as well. Does that sound good to you?
I believe we could use our time between now and 3:30 for that purpose.
That would be fantastic. All right, Democrats, let's. I need 2 minutes, but let's start up about 2:40 in caucus. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we go, did you set what the deadlines are going to be for amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Ranking Member. They'll be 10 o'clock tomorrow for requests, 5 o'clock tomorrow for posting like normal. And I think if we could spend this time caucusing on the 8 Senate bills that we have heard over the last couple of days, and we'll update the executive list, which is not complete because bills came in kind of late. We'll update that executive list this afternoon, but we should all, each caucus should talk about all 8 Senate bills that we've heard over the last couple of days. And amendment deadlines will be tomorrow. Thank you for that, Mr. Ranking Member. All right, see everybody in a couple minutes. Thanks, we are adjourned.